Let's talk, baby.
It's another week. Matt, I got virtual conference fatigue. I'm telling you what, it seems like the number of people putting on virtual conferences that stretch now for weeks and weeks.
Yes.
Every week I get an email. I'm not going to single any out because there are multiple offenders, but
it's a lot. It feels like every company that has done a conference to date is still in the midst of that conference, right? Yeah.
Right, and it's not just that it's all out there, go stream it when you can. They're adding new content every week. We've seen this from almost everybody who's at a conference this spring. That's great.
I actually think it's I get the idea in a way. I applaud the cleverness. I don't think it's effective, though.
Figuring it out, right? We're still early days in how we do all this. But, yeah, I hope somebody goes back and measures all of this and how it works. Because a lot of this stuff, right, if you're not live, if it's not, well, it doesn't have to be. If you're not interactive, let me say it that way.
Yeah.
Then it's just a recorded webinar. And I read somebody on one of my channels, and it might even been you saying this to me, right, is they're looking at the transcripts of these things and doing a whole conference in, you know, 30 minutes. And
yeah.
I'll tell you, I'm guilty, right? When I go to one of these virtual conference things, first thing I do is click through to see if there's a PowerPoint, because I'd much rather look at that sometimes.
And that's, you know, you and I have gone back and forth on the value of in-person versus, you know, does this change the way the industry? This, I think, is demonstrating, painfully possibly demonstrating, the value of the in-person interaction with your customers, analysts, partners, et cetera, et cetera. I think this is going to, for these large companies, this is going to validate the fact that they need to have these in-person events.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Now, I tell you what I do like, and I've said this before on the podcast, is I like having all of that content out there for me to consume at my leisure. Because sometimes I will go and look at things that, you know, when you and I go to a conference, it's a little bit different experience from a lot of people, right? Because we're locked into an analyst program where we're being guided along a story. But often there's a session I want to go, you know, audit and pay attention to. This allows me to go do that in a way I couldn't before. But beyond that,
well, you know, actually, you could do it before. You just didn't do it before. These sessions are all available on demand. Yes.
But then you got to download an app, and there's this whole thing. But now. I'll tell you, the other thing is, you know, in the springtime, they might all be available on demand, but we're bouncing, you know, pretty much every week going to a different location. So even if they're available on demand, who's got the time now? So what it is, a virtual conference plus quarantine.
Yeah. I'm giving you a hard time, but you're right. You know, we go literally 2 months in a row of one conference after another. You kind of, you know, 1 week kind of just blends into the next. But to what you're saying, the virtual side kind of changes your behavior a little bit with regards to the content and, you know, kind of the going in and looking at individual sessions, right? Because you're on.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, I have a bookmark folder on my browser here that says, you know, things to watch, and it's full of
them. See that bookmark folder? Can you open that up for everybody to see?
No, I'm not going to. I had nothing more to say about that. I guess two pieces of big news this week. One is the big Twitter hack yesterday. Matt, did you lose your blue check mark?
Yeah, I was so disappointed.
I got to tell you, it said verified users with a blue check mark on Twitter got hacked somehow, and a phishing link was sent out to donate bitcoins, and they would double your money. So it was only until about the third time I clicked on that link that I realized something might not be right. But those guys, they say $400,000+. People fell for it for the tune of you know, $500,000. That's crazy.
I would love to click a link saying,
if I give $1,000, I'll get $2 back, even if it's from Elon Musk.
I would Or, you're right. Cause it was Elon, it was some political leaders. I'd be curious to see the breakdown of impacted accounts, tech versus non-tech, right? I mean, like, I'd really like to know if there are any tech people out there that fell for this ruse, or this hack. And sadly, I'm sure there were a few, and I would love to publicly shame them.
And I'll tell you what, the coverage has been interesting, because if you read the popular news, the popular press, it talks about, Bitcoin scam on Twitter. You read the tech news, and it's like, this hack is worth so much more than it would have ever got out of this Bitcoin scam. This is a precursor to something else. Somebody's proving something to somebody.
Well, and that's, it's funny you say that, because I think that's the kind of news that often gets underreported. I mean, people like you and I get it, but I think your average Joe, like Wilson, who I'm in this office with, I think folks like that, they don't necessarily understand that maybe this is a test run or a dry run or, a proving capability for a nation state. And that's kind of a little bit exaggerated, but they take these as, oh, somebody just got, $400,000 out of a bunch of Twitter users. Who gives a crap? That's nothing in the big picture.
Right. Yeah. Enough for the value of a hack like that.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting. But again, the other bit of news. So, we should just, not leave anybody in suspense. This is why I never applied for the blue check mark. I didn't want to make myself vulnerable. So there was no impact to me personally. beyond a few bitcoins.
You have quite the following now on Twitter, though, don't you?
Yeah, I'm up to like 93 users or followers.
Whatever. I know you are. You're a humble guy. I don't know what your user or your follower count is now, but you've skyrocketed over the last few months. Impressively.
Well, there's this website called Fiverr.com. You heard of it? So for $5, you can get people to do anything. And anyway, the other big piece of news, just sweet. Why are you laughing?
Yeah. Well, go ahead.
I'll just read the headline. This came out yesterday, and so Dell is exploring a VMware spinoff. There's two bits to this. One is they're announcing a VMware spinoff. They're looking into it. That would take place about a year and 2 months from now. It would be the fall of 2021 because
Does that align with their fiscal end? Or?
No, it aligns to the tax penalty for selling off a company they bought in 2015, I think.
Okay.
So there's been a lot of different reactions across the Twitterverse. I think I look at this and there's a couple of things. One is, Dell took on a lot of debt to buy EMC, right? And I think at the end of the day, this is not about the value of VMware to Dell. It's about, I mean, from a relationship perspective, it's about the monetary impact. Microsoft is smart with money. I think that's really what it's all about. But you read the coverage and you read what Dell said in their filing. And there's a paragraph. Well, let me back up a little bit, right? When you and I have talked about VMware, and we talked about it with some of Dell's competitors, there's always this fear that with Dell owning VMware, that there's going to be a better together. And we started to see that story right over the past 2 years.
Yes.
That I think has allowed Nutanix inroads to places where maybe they wouldn't have been as successful, and just creates kind of this aura of fear around, what is VMware's long-term future with Dell, and how does that impact my business if I'm relying on VMware? Spinning them out, I think, is good for the broader market in terms of VMware has a lot more freedom. But then, I think these thoughts, and then I'm reading some excerpts from the filing that Dell did, and it's this is a direct quote: "Further formalization of certain mutually beneficial existing commercial relationships will be put into place, including go-to-market, R&D, co-development, intellectual property."
So even though they spin them out, they still...
No, they spin them out. They're going to formalize some of these better together relationships, it sounds like.
That's very interesting. How do you do? I mean, I guess you become contractually bound to...
Yeah.
to execute on those. So you're really not giving up that better together element, even though you
I guess it depends on how much of a stake Dell continues to hold in VMware, and then how much we look at VMware as a monopoly in their space, I guess.
Well, and you know, if you think about that a little more, right? I mean, you've been in marketing at tech companies. You've done the go-to-market agreements and co-agreements and MDF agreements with at AMD. We did them with HPE. We did them with Dell. With you name it. And you always had these formalized kind of agreements to do go-to-market activities, even co-development, right? But those can be interpreted many ways, and those can be executed many ways. If I look at that, I think, okay, but that really still doesn't bound VMware to Dell, right? Or Dell to VMware, for that matter, right?
You have to go a little bit deeper. I mean, there's two aspects. One is the go-to-market. And somebody's coverage here is talking about, from VMware's perspective, the losing all these Dell salespeople, right? But one is go-to-market. I think the ones that scare competitors more is less go-to-market and more about co-development and R&D. And for that, maybe a formalization of those kind of things as a JV, right, which is its own separate entity.
But is that an exclusive co-development? I mean, it doesn't prohibit VMware from co-developing with HPE or Lenovo. Or
no, but it gives Dell and VMware a head start as they move into kind of this new... I mean, what's VMware's incentive right now, or what's Michael Dell's incentive right now to let VMware go off and do that with an HPE or an IBM?
Nothing, but he doesn't have any incentive, right? He has an incentive to not allow it.
Right. It could be as little as a head start, and a head start that started 2 years ago. So, I don't think anybody's in any danger here with VMware spinning out of. Dell's going to make it, if they do it, right? They're going to make it beneficial.
With that said, with that said, though, you and I have spoken with all of Dell's competitors in the OEM space regarding VMware in particular. And I have to say, speaking with their competitors, never once did I hear we feel as though, there's favoritism given to Dell. I've always heard kind of very, I don't want to say positive because that sounds kind of weird, but, the thought that VMware was still an independent entity that was able to execute on go-to-market and certain programs with virtually any OEM out there. I never heard the HPE guys, Lenovo guys, Cisco guys talk about they feel like they're at a distinct disadvantage either product-wise or marketing-wise versus Dell.
Not in the short term, but I think when you look at
they always talk about maybe longer term there'd be,
Longer term, it's a risk. It's a risk. That said, right, I'm reading another thing as you were talking. I wasn't listening to you. I was there's some financial analysts who say, Dell's never going to spin it out. It's too valuable to the business. Dell's future is all around cloud and software defined, as is the industry's. And what's really happening here is Michael Dell, who's only 55, not ready to give any of this up, is trying to juice the stock price and remind the industry of the value of both companies.
That's interesting to you.
And if you're talking about a speculative transaction 15 months in the future.
Well, and that's there's a very salient point in there, right? The future is software and software defined, right? And and quite frankly, from a margins perspective, the top line is in software, so or the bottom line is in software, so it is a little bit hard to imagine kind of giving up that cash cow.
And the margins all in software.
It'll be fun to watch.
Well, until Dell starts selling ARM servers and reinvents the market there. Is there ARM news this week? Seems like this is the first week of the year there's been no ARM news.
Isn't it impressive how much momentum ARM has made in the industry, though, quietly made in the industry? I did see some AWS stuff on on their ARM instances, their Graviton instances, about it was more around performance numbers on for WordPress on.
I saw the same thing. I mean, Amazon didn't put out any numbers before in fairness to Amazon, they don't put out numbers on anything. But this, I mean, now that the Graviton instances are available, we're starting to see some kind of initial performance characteristics.
Yeah. I'd be curious to watch how this plays out over time, you know. So ARM, AWS went down this path of in-house development. I mean, granted, they bought Ian Apernis, so they bought a silicon design team, so I get that. But, you know, if they find the success that a lot of folks anticipate they will with Graviton 2, what does that mean for the Azures, the GCPs, some of these other cloud guys, the Ali cloud guys? Do they, do they look to partner with the Marvell, or do they look to do in-house development? It just seems like it'd be really expensive to go develop your own silicon.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to go develop their own silicon. And I think there's two things that factor in here, right? Amazon didn't go do Graviton because ARM is an inherently better architecture, right? For Amazon, it's all about better margin. And can I deliver a solution that's good enough where I'm making maybe a little more money if I'm not paying an Intel tax, right?
Yeah.
That's what it's about. So if I...
X86 tax. Let's call it an
x86
tax.
X86 tax.
Not just Intel. Yeah.
Yeah, too many years at AMD, right? In the Intel MBF. So if I'm Azure or if I'm Google, right? I'm looking at it through the same lens. And are my offerings competitive with Graviton? I don't think the architecture matters at the end of the day quite as much. People are looking to ARM as a way to get out from under that x86. We're seeing it in the cloud, and that's 100% what's behind what is the most recent ARM news, which is Apple switch to ARM in their PCs.
This kind of drives the whole, we've had this discussion a million times around kind of the commoditization of compute, right? And especially when you talk about cloud, let's not talk about kind of on-prem server stuff, but when you talk about cloud, you want, best performance at the best cost, and you don't really care what it's running. You don't, quite frankly, you don't care if it's Intel or AMD 90%, 99% of the time, right? You certainly, and that line between ARM versus x86 or power for that matter, it goes away.
Yeah, right. And the old people in the audience are getting a little bit of sense of deja vu, because in 19, let's just say the mid to late 90s, right, we saw exactly the same thing happen as all of these RISC architectures from name your favorite computer vendor all kind of collapsed on this little, I think I can 486 chip or Pentium chip from Intel. Right? Let's get out from under the big tax that we're paying ourselves for developing, PA RISC or whatever. It's a repeat of that a little bit, right? For the same reasons.
See, and this is where I think, and I know I'm alone in thinking this, but this is where my head goes on this whole ARM thing. It's the, and you just hit it on the head. When, this Intel thing came out in the mid-90s, right? When you saw it start to take hold in the data center, it was they had a very specific use case or deployment model for those Intel servers, right? It was file and print, and that was it. And directory services, and that was it, right? I was never going to trust my database environment or my big enterprise environment to the Wintel story, right? It was all, whether it was HP UX or Solaris, it was all Unix derivatives in those chips that came from those vendors. And ARM is kind of similar. They actually have about 25% market share in the data center. It's routers, it's all equipment, right? It's not servers, it's very few servers, it's all the equipment. But they're finding these kind of fixed function use cases that are working for them. And as these kind of gain more prominence in the data center, there's going to be that moment where collectively the market wakes up and goes, wait a minute, why aren't we?
Right. And with things like Graviton, you're seeing whole tool chains evolving and saying ARM is fantastic for kind of Lambda functions and things that aren't high performant, right? same conversations we had about Intel, again, you know, in 1997, it's, am I going to trust my data center to this 486 chip that needs a floating point, whatever?
Right. You know. Right. Yeah. I think it truly is this evolution of compute. And, you know, as you kind of further go along that, you see these companies, you know, Marvell is, you know, they're more of the traditional ARM kind of deployment or development and deployment and sell through. But you see these graph cores and these very specific silicon functions coming out that are turning these, you know, it's turning the data center into almost like, you know, an amalgamation of black boxes where, you know, I remember when digital electronics first came out and it was like, you know, you never had to go in with your O-scope and kind of look at, you know, testing a resistor or a capacitor. It was just this card or this module's dead, pull it out and replace it. That's kind of how it feels. Compute is starting to move with all these new specialized architectures that are very fixed in their function, whether it's for, you know, inference or whether it's for, you know, NFV or, you know, but it's very, very specialized with very specialized characteristics.
Oh yeah, and ARM's business model keeps the bar very low for doing that kind of thing.
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to go off on that, but it's interesting.
You're good. So, you know, Intel and AMD are in no danger of going away, but did this force them to take a harder look at their business model, especially around more kind of the entry level today? But ARM's not sitting still, and their whole ecosystem benefits when something like Graviton is released. And we haven't seen yet what Apple's going to do on the desktop. Right.
Yeah.
We've seen what they can do in a very kind of power thermal constrained iPad environment. You take those constraints out, and I'm expecting, right, we're going to see some competitive stuff, at least at the high end of the client.
Let me ask you. So, you know, you're an Apple guy, and I know we're kind of data center guys, but you know, you're an all around kind of nerd. What do you think about Apple committing to ARM in the client? I mean, do you look at that and think heresy, or oh my gosh, what the hell?
I'll tell you. My fear is the same knee-jerk fear we were talking about, right? I'm talking to you on an iMac right now. I do a lot of work on this thing, and it's only a 3-year-old iMac, but I can stress it. So when I think about ARM and this platform, I'm thinking about, does it have enough oomph? I don't care about the architecture, right? If the software can support it and give me the performance, I really don't care, Matt. I don't know what's in my client.
And but you do have that initial knee-jerk reaction, though, right?
Of course I did, right? Yeah. Because, you know, I was hoping that Apple would go and announce, you know, a 24-core Ryzen and right. Go in the other direction. So we'll see, right? I still have that fear. I can't overcome that. And we're going to have to see what they come out with. I was going to say, I do like the approach they're taking with the software, because their x86 software, they're doing two things. One is there's a tool that runs that transpiles it ahead of execution. So you're not doing kind of real-time transposition from x86 to ARM. Anyway, I like how they're talking about it, but the proof's going to be in the pudding. So until we see these boxes.
So there's one point I want to make and one question I have for you. The point is understanding, you know, the kind of the wisdom, if you will, of Apple, and kind of, you know, they certainly, I feel as though they wouldn't be making such public pronouncements if there was not a certain level of certainty around what we're going to see from a performance perspective, right? I find it hard to believe they would kind of make such a big bet not knowing what the outcome was going to look like.
Yeah, no, I'm there. And and the other point to make about Apple and the ARM transition is they've said that's their direction. They haven't tied that to any products. So, you know, if you look at the strata of Apple products, you know, I would have no problem, I think, if I were a MacBook Air user, right? The $1,000 entry level, I'm doing web browsing and Office with an ARM, right? The thought wouldn't even come to me. I think when you start moving up into power user, and I'll put myself there because, you know, I'm doing video and other things. you know, maybe that's not an arm part for 5 years.
Right? Yeah.
It's evolutionary. And all of I started to go down a software path earlier, and the reason for that was you look at when Microsoft tried to get into the ARM space with Windows RT, I guess, whatever it was, a few years back.
Yeah. And I had one of those.
and that failed not because it was, well, it failed because it failed largely because the software experience was subpar, right? I had to have x86 or I had to have ARM. There was no portability. It was a different kind of experience even between the two.
Absolutely correct.
I think Apple's taken a software first approach, and by making all of that invisible, it becomes, it shouldn't matter, right?
Yeah.
And that's where they're going to be strong.
So is that, you know, is that part is, that's a, I'm assuming that's an Apple designed piece of silicon, right? They have their own design team that's working on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Yeah. They've been doing this for years, right? They put it in the iPhone first and then the iPad, and now they're scaling it up.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a lot of movement between the engineers working on these products across the ecosystem, let me say it that way. So there's a lot of, I think, informal IP sharing going on that's, I think, helping the entire industry. And we've seen that in x86 forever.
Yes.
So you know, when I say Graviton helps Apple, Apple's going to help Graviton. All these guys are helping Marvell and whomever else.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a good time to be in that world. And the x86 guys are trying to figure out how they can continue to get the margins and ASPs that they're getting.
And to what you're saying, I mean, I don't see, and it, well, that's a good point, actually. I was going to say, I don't see Intel and AMD going away anytime, ever. I don't rephrase that. But to what you're saying about the keeping the ASPs and margins where they were, that's the biggest challenge, right? Because the ARM ecosystem is, or let me rephrase that, ARM-based solutions are vastly less expensive.
And one of the most interesting pieces of the whole Apple ARM thing, this didn't make news anywhere, but in one of the technical sessions at the Apple Developer Conference, we were talking about how to be ready for this. They put up a slide that talked about GPU support. And it's like the ARM is only going to support the Apple GPU, which we've heard almost nothing about.
Really?
So they're not, at least as of now, right? They're not talking about drivers for an AMD and trying to marry the AMD graphics parts to their A16.
I'm kind of curious about that play as well. GPUs more than CPUs seem to have a certain amount of religion associated with them, right?
They have religion, and especially as you move up the chain. And this is one of the reasons my iMac is a little bit underpowered, because I did not opt for a good GPU. But now, you know, if you're doing video or even photo editing, everything is GPU accelerated now. And it's frustrating, because I also play a little bit around with AI and machine learning. It's my hobby. All of that is an NVIDIA thing, and Apple gave up NVIDIA support two years ago.
I love your hobbies. I'll leave it at that. That's funny.
Yeah, the machine behind me there, that's a Windows machine running Windows WSL, Windows Services for Linux. Which is amazing too, because I can run a full Ubuntu kernel on a Windows machine with direct access to my GPU, so I can run my the reason it's a hobby, I'm doing some special image recognition, man, I can't talk about.
It's just a little bit disconcerting to see myself pop up on your screen behind you. Speaking of video recognition.
So here's the thing, right? I'm using a piece of software called vMix to record us, and it doesn't run on Mac.
All right.
So we're using Skype to record this. Skype outputs this soft camera signal. It's called NDI. It's available on the network. So my Windows machine sees your camera and I can record.
It's interesting that I don't want to call it a video editing, but a video-related piece of software would not be supported on Mac. I guess Skype being owned by Microsoft is, but that's a third-party app, right? It's not.
It's a third-party app, and I'll tell you why. This piece of software actually comes out of the professional production world, which is not an Apple world at all, right? If you go into a production van anywhere, all of these tools are built on Windows.
Sure. We went way off the rails on this, but it's been an interesting conversation. I don't know how we got from VMware to ARM and Macs and iPads, but fascinating nonetheless.
Do you have anything else to say about VMware spinoff?
No, but it's so kind of, and I brought this up a little bit earlier before we started recording. You know, I think one of the things that's interesting as it relates to Dell, as it relates to HPE, as it relates to Lenovo, and even in the software side, the VMwares, the Nutanixes, and so on and so forth. And we actually hit on this a little bit, but I know we talk about it a lot, but I'm fascinated by the blurring of the lines that exist in the data center, and from a go-to-market perspective of the OEMs, of the distinct products that get sold as servers, as storage boxes, as, you know, routers, switches, so on and so forth, and this convergence that's going on and the blurring of lines, right? I mean, is it an HCI solution? Is it a server or is it a storage solution? You know, analytics boxes, you know, are they really high-end storage box or analytics server? Are there solutions? Are they really high-end storage boxes, or are they servers that have storage in them? It's like, it feels like this traditional kind of rack 'em stack 'em world. This just continues. There's an acceleration in the kind of blurring of what we mean when we talk about servers and storage and all that. What are your thoughts?
I think you're right.
You don't care.
We've seen this. I mean, this has been. I'm going to say this started in 2006 with the introduction of the hypervisor. Let me say it a different way. So it's not the introduction of the hypervisor, where we really started to see the hypervisor.
Become a mainstay. Yeah, I get you. Whenever a server starts shipping,
hypervisor become the bare metal server. Yeah. And all of a sudden, I'm not deploying against bare metal. I'm deploying against hypervisors, and then that introduced the idea of you know, workload locality or portability. Right now, now I can be motion, and it was painful going through those times. Right when you could only be motion to like steppings on your CPU and things like that. Right, but we solved that. Fast forward. And I think we're seeing the same thing, as you said, right, with storage, with server, with networking. We just saw HPE buy another software-defined WAN company this week, right, as part of their edge strategy. It's not about Cisco routers. It's about, you know, it's about building my networks on software bits that can run on whatever infrastructure happens to be underneath me. That resonates with IT buyers. You and I, we had a call two days ago with one of the big OEMs who said, we do our messaging and the stuff that really is sticky is the stuff around solutions, because that's what the IT guys are asking for, right? Asking for, you know, we're at a point in the history of technology where pretty much everything is good enough.
Yeah.
There are no bad choices. There simply aren't. If I look at the storage world and if I'm buying an all-flash array, there's not a bad choice. I could buy it from anybody and it's going to overserve my needs. But if I want to do storage for AI, right, it's maybe a collection of things and it's not a box. It's a box running six different pieces of software. So I'm just validating what you said, I think. But I think it's a very real trend, and I think it's driven by, the up-leveling of how IT is approaching problems, right? The age of the specialist is over.
Yeah, I think you're seeing a cloudification of IT, right, where they become service providers to the business, and you're just giving out instances, and you've got to manage it in such a way. So it kind of, you know, you and so what do you measured on cost, you're measured on agility and reliability, right? And that moves you, that kind of shifts the way you think as an IT service provider, if you will. But what's interesting about all that, though, is, and you hit on it, is even though there's this kind of this thinking around the commoditization of all these bits and bytes and components, in some ways, infrastructure has never been more important, right? So if you think about standing up an AI cluster, right, or some of these new, these nascent kind of trends that are starting to move out of nascency into kind of mainstream, those require a different set of characteristics underneath from a hardware perspective to make them effective and make them worthwhile, right? So in some ways, even though you as an IT guy don't care about what's sitting underneath, it does matter from a workload, standing up that workload perspective.
Absolutely matters, but I have to say two things about that. One is, this is where we're, I think, seeing increased value from the channel, the system integrators, and this, especially as we start looking toward applications like, or not applications, but we start looking at general classes of workloads like Edge, right?
Yeah.
Or hybrid cloud. There's a lot of this going on. I've been spending a lot of time lately talking to the media and entertainment guys in Hollywood for a project. You know, that's a CI-driven world. You know, they care about latency, they care about performance, but at the end of the day, the customer doesn't know anything except I need files and I need to run these workloads, right? So I think the age of the specialist for IT guys is shrinking. You still need those guys somewhere, but at the end of the day, I want to, you call it a cloudification. I think it's, and maybe we're saying the same thing, but I think we're in the age of everything as a service.
Yeah. Cloud services. That's where I was going.
And it's not just the channel guys that are helping and benefiting from this. We're also seeing the OEM set up tools to drive this, right? I think everybody now is, at least in, you know, around storage and server, you know, running predictive analytics somewhere in their infrastructure, right? We're just making sizing recommendations. So I think the intelligence starts to become, I mean, we've talked about the autonomous data center forever, but that's, I think, where we're seeing, we're seeing some real activity and trending is, let's put some intelligent software that's watching our operations that can make the recommendations about, do I need to upgrade my controller? Less about what are the speeds and feeds of that CPU.
Yeah. And I think from a monitoring and management perspective, this goes back to what we were talking about earlier in that we've gone from, you know, kind of going in and, you know, all kinds of doing very low level diagnostics and maintenance on servers to a, this box is dead, you know, bring in your shopping cart, pull it out, plug in the new one, power it on, and it'll automatically, you know, provision itself and, or, you know, configure and provision itself.
And that's where, you know, that's where virtualization and hyperconvergence and things like that are, they're hiding that from you. And you know, this is a natural evolution, not just because it doesn't matter so much in the data center and we want solutions, but you used the word cloudification again. And it's, you know, just as ESX brought us this idea of vMotion and workload portability within my data center or within a rack at that time. The cloud gives us that ability to move that workload anywhere, right? It's either in my data center, maybe it's running on HP GreenLake, which is sort of in my data center, or it's up on Amazon. And the IT guys don't want to learn three different technologies or three different environments. Right? They want to push a button and get database as a service. And it's interesting, I've said database as a service. One of the things that's been announced since we talked last time, you know, Amazon has had this outpost thing where they're kind of bringing cloud services on-prem to solve some of the latency problems, you know, of being cloud-centric. They're moving their database as a service, RDS, into that environment as well. So the lines are blurred. So if you want to live in that world as an IT guy, you need to learn about databases wherever they live, right? Or AI or ML or Edge or software-defined, whatever.
Yes, and you have to be prepared for a business unit that is far more intelligent when it comes to these technologies than they were 5 or 10 years ago as well, right? No longer are they looking for you to stand up a database environment for them or an analytics environment for them. They're looking to do it themselves. All right, well, that was fun. Thanks for indulging me, Steve. I appreciate it.
What do you think about Citrix and Microsoft getting together and saying Citrix is the right solution for remote desktop on Azure?
Man, how long have Citrix and Microsoft been partnering and saying that Citrix is the right environment, desktop environment, remote desktop environment for insert, you know, latest?
Uh-huh. And Citrix is the next takeover target for Microsoft. We've been saying now, I think, for exactly 24 years.
Since they've been in full, since they were in Fort Lauderdale, yeah. Yeah, that's great. That's great. Yeah, you know what's funny is Citrix is one of those companies that they have been around forever, right? And you're right. They're the original kind of remote and desktop guys from way, way back, from terminal services and kind of wrapping their goodness around it. And I'm actually a little bit surprised that they are not more dominant in the market from a visibility perspective than they are. When you think of remote desktop today as an IT person, you know, a lot of folks I speak to, they immediately go to Horizon, VMware Horizon. And it's like, what about these guys that kind of are, you know, that for the, you know, the original, the OGs in the remote desktop space? And they're almost thought of in a legacy way.
Yeah, well, yeah, and I think part of this, and we've seen this not just with Citrix, right? I think you look in the HCI space, scale computing kind of fits into this bucket, right? Very solid technology, one of the, if not the first player out there. But you know what? These guys aren't Silicon Valley companies. And
yeah.
They don't live in that hype bubble out there. People don't pay attention to them as much. Citrix, as you said, was a Fort Lauderdale company, you know, sales in Indiana. It's a different mindset and way of looking at these guys, and they're plodding along, making plenty of money, giving value to their customers.
Citrix in particular, they're kind of like AMD in that they may be based in Fort Lauderdale, but their center of gravity has moved out into the valley now. They carry a lot more influence out there. And they had a big name at one point. I mean, in the early days of remote desktop, they were very, very well known.
Maybe they just peaked early, Matt, because in 1999, you're right. If you want a remote desktop, that was it. Then flash forward a decade, and the way you spell remote desktop is...
man, that hurts.
BDI.
That's hurtful, man. You're right, though. You're right. And Microsoft had their run at it. You know, they had some really good, clearly they would, but some really good solutions there in the mid-2000s around virtual desktop. But
here's a look at Citrix and think about the Citrix story, and this has nothing to do with the news this week. What boggles my mind is that Microsoft didn't jump on this thing 25 years ago and just dominate the space. How could they let a Citrix grow and thrive? And we talk about remote desktop, especially right now when the whole world has gone remote desktop. And the word Microsoft doesn't even come up, right? Yeah. Windows weird is what that? I need to deliver.
Yeah. That makes no sense, right?
Right. Right. And you look at the early days of Citrix, and I was working on things that were close to that in the late 90s. They had co-engineering relationships with Microsoft, right? These guys were sharing IP. Microsoft had to let Citrix into the stack in a way other partners weren't allowed in at the time to make their solution work, which is why the, you know, acquisition rumors were ever present.
They were, and that relationship was, you know, was tighter than kissing cousins. I mean, they had access into source code that other companies did not, which is what makes this so interesting. And I talk about, you know, I almost look at them as legacy now. And I'm speaking to a lot of folks, they look at them more in a legacy way. It's like you kind of draw a parallel to some of these tech giants of years past, even like an IBM. You know, it's like, yeah, we still have that Oracle, right? We have that presence. We still use them. But, you know, you would think with the stranglehold they had on the market that either, Microsoft would have come in and swooped them up and integrated everything into Windows Desktop or Windows Server, or they would have found ways to establish, to ensure they had leadership in you know, these kind of remote desktop stories today, right? Like the, with like VMware, it's just weird that they don't. It just makes no sense to me.
Nor to me.
Anyway,
what else you got? That's all I had on my list. We've been talking a long time. I don't know if we've said anything useful to anybody.
No, but it's been fun.
It's always good to see your turkey.
Thank you. There we go. Is that a better view?
At certain angles, it sticks right out of the corner of your head like a...
like it's either attacking me or flying out of my ear.
Exactly.
That's funny.
What do we got on deck? So it's July, and there's not a lot of news, right? Spinning out in July. Everybody's on vacation.
It is dead.
Some product announcements, but nothing earth-shattering.
Nothing coming up in the near future either. It's a very quiet summer.
Catching up on work. How you surviving the lockdown and the quarantine? You getting Torchies delivered to your house?
You know, we got Torchies delivered the other night, actually, and my oldest swore he got food poisoning from it.
We are not sponsored by Torchies this week.
No, we're sponsored by Yeti. No. I think I'm calling BS on him, I think. But Yeti? Yeah. No, on my son. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. How are you surviving it?
We're doing great, man. We're doing great here at the mm-hmm. I get lonely. I don't see people. So, you know, I play back our old podcast and. All right, that's it. That's it here from Data Center Central.
Sponsored by Yeti and Torchies.
My time here, food poisoning and Torchies getting me hungry.